Hello, good morning, and thank you very much for turning up to this, what I am sure will turn out to be a fairly confessional session. 30 bad habits of server administrators. And by confessional, I mean I'm going to go through some habits, and they're probably going to be, some of them are going to be very boring, all of them are going to be bad. But even before I started, I had some people in the audience say to me, "Oh, I've got some bad habits that I want to talk about." And I thought, great. And at certain times, I am going to call on you to share your own bad habits. Like we had one gentleman here who worked with a colleague who decided that it would be excellent security practice to have a text file in the sysvol folder on Inactive Directory that had the domain administrator credentials in plain text sitting there. So that's actually worse and better than some of the other stuff I'm talking about. I'm talking about very basic stuff, but as I talk, I am sure that you're going to think of bad things. And feel free to put your hand up, and I'll call on you, and you will admit your sin. Or the person you work with's sin. I've got a friend named Frank, and he did this. Is there anybody named Frank in the audience? Good. Because we're blaming Frank for a lot of things today. So, I was getting my house renovated, and my builder came and he said, "Oh, your house was built by a builder that lived here." And I said, "How did you know?" Because that was true. It was the person I'd bought it from had been a builder. And he says, "Because builders often live in unfinished houses, and your house is a bit unfinished. Chefs rarely cook extravagant meals at home. They tend to be very simple in the way that they cook at home. They don't go out and make what they make at the restaurant. And server administrators recognise good security practice. They just don't get around to doing it in their own production environment." Now, server administrators develop these bad habits because, well, there's a number of reasons, and all of them sound really excellent when you say them to yourself at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm practicing reactive server administration. Reactive server administration is simply that you don't have the chance to actually be proactive and do things in a planned manner. That is that you are always reacting to problems. And when you're reacting to problem, your first goal is to solve the problem. Solving a problem does not mean solving it in the best way. Solving a problem simply means solving the problem so that it's not hassling you right at the moment. And that's sometimes how we end up with things. It's literally, "I know this is a big, fat, dirty hack, but I'm going to do it because I've got 30 other things on my list in the next hour, and if I did this properly, it'd take me 5 hours to do." There is an unwillingness to pull on loose threads. Who here has seen something, a bit of configuration, where they know, "Oh gosh, someone should not have done that," but they're afraid to change it because you know when you go and change, you know, you pull out that Jenga stick and the whole tower falls over. Anybody here had that feeling? Repent your sins. "I don't have time." "I don't have time" is an excellent one. There's, if you read all of these self-help books, they say all the time, "No, you must solve the problem properly so you don't have to do it again." No, we just patch, and we keep patching and putting spackle on there. We don't replace the wall, and it just ends up being all repair, no wall. There's a description in Terry Pratchett's books of what a witch's cottage is. And it's a cottage that has been repaired so many times that there is no existence of the original cottage left. And for some people, their configuration of servers, their configuration of their entire infrastructure and environment is all repairs, and there's no actual infrastructure left. This is only a test machine for a dev environment. It will never end up in production. How many times have we promised ourselves, "It's only for test," and then suddenly, wow, it's running, been running in production for 5 years. I probably should do something about the way I configured that. Frank did it. This is excellent, because it's always, you've always worked, you've either come into the job after a guy or a girl. Let's not be discriminative here. Frank could have been a girl. Frank most likely was a guy, because they're certainly a bit more cowboy about things. And they've configured things in a certain way. When I went first into private enterprise, I started working as a sysadmin in a university. I went out into private enterprise and I was replacing a developer who had been wearing the systems administrator hat. And this guy did some remarkable things. One of my favourites was the fact that he needed to send mail in a particular format. And the environment at the time had Lotus Domino. But the only way he could do this was with Exchange. So he deployed an NT4 domain, he put an Exchange server into the domain, and he had one account on the Exchange server so it could send one message a day as a mailbox. Now that is a Frank did it. And I bet everybody here has seen that sort of thing and you're just going, why? Why would you do that? It's considered a low priority problem. Simply, there's other things you need to solve. This one, okay, I'm going to do something bad. I know I'm doing it bad, but it's not like it's a really important server. It's not a really important server. It's just a little server that's sitting over here doing this. It doesn't really need a good configuration. It just needs to work. Management keeps prioritizing stupid rubbish that stops people from doing their proper job. Anybody had that happen to them? You've all got intelligent management, I see. Well, aren't we all lucky? Now, why is it important to ensure that you don't do these things, other than not ending up as a subject as at a talk at Ignite? You certainly don't want to be like that guy from a particularly large computer company who used Configuration Manager to deploy a task sequence to every server hosting banks information in Australia that formatted the hard disk. That was a nice one. The person who was the head of that company had to fly on their private jet all the way down to Australia and apologise because they took out the bank for 2 days. Why is it important not to ensure that you do, well, you don't do these things? I'm going to say security. I mean, there's personal pride. But if we all had personal pride, would we still be systems administrators? So let's go with security. A large number of attacks succeed, and when you read after attack reports, you understand that these attacks have succeeded simply because at some point in the chain, someone has done something inadvisable. That there has been some sort of poor security configuration. And that's what attackers look for. They look for that weakest link in the chain. Now, the interesting stat, and the one that you need to recognise, and it's not one we naturally think of, is that 30% of attacks come from within your organisation. The thing about IT pros today, IT pros, on average, are 42 years old. It's a very nice Douglas Adams number. But what that means is that many of us have been in the industry 15 or 20 years. And when we started in the industry, the people we worked with were, to call them technologically illiterate was to be generous. To call them technologically incompetent was probably a bit more accurate. However, spin forward 15 or 20 years and suddenly we're dealing with digital natives. We're dealing with people who grew up with technology, people for whom their first operating system was Windows XP. Now, for most of us, our first operating system, and it's not going to be for everybody here, was probably Windows 3.1 or maybe DOS. Anybody here work with Windows NT as part of their job when it was out in production? See, about 40% of the room. So what I'm talking about here is I'm talking about reconceptualising your idea of who a threat is. Because 30% of the people in your 30% of attacks are likely to come within your organisation. Doesn't mean 30% of the people are evil. It just means that you'll have one or two evil people who are doing those attacks. And as I was talking about yesterday in a session, you've got kids on YouTube making YouTube videos at 11 who are teaching other kids how to hack and use tools like Metasploit or other Wireshark. Now, when you've got 11-year-olds that know how to use Wireshark and Metasploit, you can imagine what they're going to be like by the time they get into the workforce. There was another amazing stat that came out last year. In the Fortune 500 in the US, 30% of companies had Tor traffic on their internal network, even though they had locked down configurations. So what's happening is that people are putting Tor on a USB, the Tor browser on a USB stick, and they're running that browser so that they can get around the corporate firewall policies. So 30% of attacks come from insiders. So if we think about this weakest link thing, there's a really good reason, in that you've got people who might not be sophisticated attackers but are using attack tools that go out and search for these weakest links. Stuff that you might consider low priority detritus may actually provide an attacker with a route into your network. And routes into networks are often unobvious, except for in hindsight, where they're amazingly obvious and, oh my gosh, why didn't I think of that? What you don't want to do is end up in a meeting explaining to someone why you didn't get round to doing something that you knew was really, really, really dumb. Fixing something that you knew was dumb. It was one of those round to-its. Don't let the procrastinators, which is not a Harry Potter spell but seems to affect many systems administrators, affect you. So let's talk some bad habits. Service accounts with passwords that do not expire. Anybody here know this one? A single service account used for all services in the organisation. Anybody here know that one? A couple. Yeah, Frank, thank you. Service accounts using the same default password that is not configured to expire. Anybody know that one? A few of you, okay. Service account management, password management is tedious. There's a reason why we end up using the same default password and configuring it never to expire. That's just because the thought of going through and changing the passwords of all of those service accounts, not only within Active Directory, but on each server and with each in each application that uses those, is horrific. We sort of sit there and go, oh my gosh, are you kidding? Getting security right is generally quite tedious. The solution to service accounts is a thing called group managed service accounts. Now, group managed service accounts came out in Server 2008 R2, and with group managed service accounts in 2012 and 2012 R2 and 2016. So what these do, they're a special account type, and the whole point of them is that password management's automatically handled by Active Directory. You configure this special account in AD, you install the account on any server you want to use the account on, then you can use the group managed service account for services. And then what happens is that the service account password is automatically updated in Active Directory according to your password policy. It's basically fire and forget. The idea is that this is a low privileged account used for services, but you're able to give the services only the privileges it needs. So that's built into server. Now, there is a limited version available in 2008 R2 that's only one machine. So you have to create an account in Active Directory for each machine. With group managed service accounts, they're much better because you can use them for things like clusters where you've got multiple machines. A virtual service account is a local version of that account. And more and more and more applications are supporting this because this now has been around for a couple of years, and you'd be surprised. Obviously, if you've got a little text configuration file with the account password in there, I'm hoping you don't, but some things work this way, then that's not going to work. But look into using group managed service accounts. There are other solutions as well that I'll talk about a little later. Service accounts that are in the domain admins group. Anybody know this one? Right. Do we all understand that this is not a good thing? Frank does, yes. No, Frank doesn't. That's why Frank does it. Service accounts at a member of the local administrators group on a particular machine, who, when they're sitting there doing their privileges, they're trying to figure out the privilege for the service account, goes, bugger it. I could sit there with group policy for 20 minutes and assign this account to all of the appropriate policies that give it the appropriate rights. I could sit there with the registry and edit the permissions on the registry, or I could put this account in the local administrators group and no one would know. This happens because it's a really quick way of making a service account that needs privileges work. It's really simple to do, and that's why we do this. This is easy. We get lazy, we do it because of all of those reasons I was talking about. It can take some time to configure local group policy and permissions correctly. And sometimes, let's face it, application vendors that give us this set of instructions on what permissions to set, stuff up the instructions, we follow it all, we've spent 30 minutes configuring the permissions on this damn thing, and then we turn it on and it doesn't work. And we sit there and go, well, I tried to do the right thing, and now I'm going to add that service account to the local administrators group. And it works, and I feel good about myself. Okay, anybody want to suggest a bad habit before I go on? Something silly that you've seen. You had some. Do you got any more? Didn't you have a script or something that had... Oh, there's the one in the sysfile folder. Anybody else? No. Oh, yes. Okay, so there you go. New admin passwords for local machines. The way to deploy it is putting it in a Visual Basic script in the NetLogon folder. That's all secure, isn't it? And it was all the same password in clear text. Now, administrator accounts that have passwords that are configured never to expire. It's one thing to do these with service accounts. Who uses an administrator account who's using exactly the same password as it was last year? Oh, yeah, I know Frank is. I bet there's more people than just put their bloody hand up then, too. Pardon? Oh, okay, well, aren't you good? I worked with a guy when I first got to... This is a guy I worked with when I was at the University of Melbourne. And when I first got my chance to admin the servers, he gave me the administrator password for the servers. And that was the account I was going to use for the next few years. No, it was in the next few weeks while he was away. Because he was going on leave, and that was my first chance to, you know, completely be in charge because I didn't have my safety net with me. He went away, came back. Now, a couple of years later, he went over to Silicon Valley. And I was visiting him in Silicon Valley. And he said, I bet you can log on to this server. And I said, are you using the same freaking password that you were using 4 years ago at Melbourne University? And he went, yeah, it's a really good password. To search for accounts that have non-expiring password, there's a simple PowerShell command that you can use. Search AD account dash password never expires. That'll show you every account in the organisation that is actually configured with a non-expiring password. If you are actually interested in not only confessing your sins, but perhaps doing something about them, or having Frank do something about them, you can run commandlets like that to get a very quick idea about what's going on. Now, if you're attacking someone's network, not that anybody here is doing that, this is the sort of thing that you run. You go and try and run these low privilege or these commands just to footprint the organisation that you're actually trying to get yourself into. Day-to-day account is a member of the administrators group on day-to-day machines. So what I'm talking about here is I bet in your SOE environment that you avoid giving normal users local admin privileges on their machine. Who here actually gives their everyday users, not in a BYOD environment, just in a SOE environment where you've got managed desktop, who here gives normal users like Bob from accounts local administrator access on the machine? Does anybody do that? Okay. Now, who here has a policy to never do that? Most of you, right. Who here kind of violates that policy when it comes to their own account on their own machine? Right? Because let's face it, all of those organisational policies apply to everybody except the IT department. This is why we end up with non-expiring administrator accounts. This is why we end up with admins who, of course, have admin privileges on their own workstations. Even though everyone else in the organisation does not have this right. And this is this other thing, is that we understand why we do this to other people, but then we have a blind spot when it comes to ourselves. Now, there's a really good reason why you should not have that blind spot. One of the things that came out in the Snowden leaks was an NSA slide deck that said if you're going to attack an organisation, what you do is you socially engineer the administrator. Because it's easier to socially engineer an administrator than it is to actually go and perform a technical attack. Why? Because administrators tend to have all of these little habits, and if you can get their credentials, you don't worry about getting anybody else's credentials. So sophisticated attackers, you're the biggest target in your organisation for someone who's wanting to attack your organisation. If they can get your credentials, they're golden. And that's why you should always check your workstation if you're in an open area for keyloggers and things like that. Because again, if you've got one of these clever little millennials who's thinking, I want to hack the server, they can go online and they can go and buy keyloggers for a very small amount of things. And if they can get into your office, they can go and plug it into your back of your machine between your keyboard, and then maybe they can go and get your credentials. Derelict administrator accounts. A derelict administrator account is basically Frank's left the organisation. Frank left the organisation some time ago, but for some reason, Frank's account is still in Active Directory. Who here knows that there are accounts of people who have worked in the IT department that are still in Active Directory even though they left more than 6 months ago? Yep, and this is not unusual. I've had audience where 80% of the hands have gone up. People are getting a bit better with it, but what often happens is that administrator accounts are not deprovisioned. And one of the reasons that that happens is that there is a concern that if we get rid of Frank's account, something's going to stop working because Frank put all of these bloody hacks into the system. So if we just leave it there, it's good. There's always a tendency, I'm not going to go and pull on loose strings. An example of this, in my own professional life, I went to work at this big industrial enterprise, and there was a guy who was junior to me, who was a contractor, and his job was mostly just to do service desk, and I was looking after servers. And for some reason, he'd managed to lock himself out of his account. And I was in a meeting, and I said, look, I'll get to it in 40 minutes. Because I can't do it right now. This is back in the days when you weren't all carrying laptops to meetings. Anyway, so I came out of the meeting and I went over and I said, oh, look, I'll go and fix that. And he said, oh, you don't need to. And I said, why? And he said, oh, because I remembered Frank's credentials. And Frank had left. I'd been replacing Frank. And he said, oh, yeah, I remembered Frank's credentials. So I just logged on with his account and unlocked my own. And I thought, wow, there's so many things wrong with that. But more problematic, if you look at some of the most absolutely damaging attacks that have occurred in history, they've often been when a systems administrator or an IT pro has left an organisation, sometimes even under good circumstances, often when they've been unhappy. And then what happens is, you know, a couple of weeks later, they actually go and test their credentials again, and they find that they've still got remote access, and their credentials haven't been removed, and then, you know, they finally snap, because we know we were all that close to snapping. But maybe, what would it be like? It's, you know, it's like that picture of the guy who's just falling out of the building going, I just want to know what it's like to fall. I don't want to know about the ground. I just want to know about the falling bit. And they snap, and they go in and, you know, then you read about so-and-so in Texas was charged with destroying $4 million worth of data 6 months after their employment was terminated because someone didn't turn off their account. So to search for accounts that haven't signed on for 90 days, there's again a very simple PowerShell command. Just do that, and that'll tell you every account that hasn't signed on for 90 days. Now, as a matter of policy, you should probably have some sort of account policy where if people aren't signing on for a certain amount of time, you can write a script that'll run every day and then it'll simply lock out their account. So you lock their account. And the good thing about that is, if they don't sign on, you might have it. If you don't sign on for 2 weeks, we just automatically have your account locked. So even if you've been on holiday, you have to ring someone to have your account re-enabled. You figure out what time works for you, but there is no reason if someone's not using an account not to lock it out. Now I've talked about giving yourself local administrator privileges. There's also what's actually perhaps worse, which is that you are using a domain admin account to sign onto your local workstation. Who here does that? No one. Oh. You've all become very shy. You're all like, are we going to admit our sins? And now it's like, yeah, we're not looking too good. Now, why is this a problem? Well, it's like using a building master key to unlock your office. Why is it really important not to do this? Well, who here has heard of a pass the hash attack? Good. Okay, so pass the hash attack, for those of you who haven't heard it, is an attack that you can run against a local computer. You run it against a local computer, and what you can do is you can extract the password hash of an account. Then you can use that in a replay attack against another computer and then get access to that computer and then spider your way across the network. This is almost impossible to defend against using current technology, simply because of the way that password credentials are cached. And Microsoft's been working really hard on ways to mitigate and completely block this attack. But why you want to minimise the utilisation of, when you've got these super privileged accounts, you really want to lock down where they can be used, is that simply you don't want someone, and the problem with your own workstation is that especially if you've given yourself local admin privileges and you're surfing Reddit or you're surfing whatever and you're downloading tools and experimenting with tools, sometimes those tools are going to have nasties in them. And what you don't want to have is you don't want to download something onto your workstation and then have it go and harvest credentials and then start an automatic pass the hash attack across your network. Because at some point you've logged into your machine with domain admin credentials and it uses those to go and compromise every other server in your organisation. Solutions to pass the hash. Now it's very difficult, as I said, to guard against. You minimise the use of accounts that have wide-ranging privileges and ensure that they're only used on hosts where they need to be used. Now, Windows 10 and Windows Server 2016 include a new technology called Credential Guard. Now, what Credential Guard does is it actually uses virtualization to create a special virtualized container in which to host these credentials. And that means that pass the hash attacks don't work at the moment, and there's a whole lot of videos up on Microsoft's websites where they sort of explain some of the technologies. But by virtualizing it, they use also a TPM, and they can store the data in a TPM as well. So going forward, we're going to have a lot of security, but we all know. Who here's still got Server 2003 in their environment? All right, so there is an operating system that's 13 or 14 years old. Needless to say, by the time Windows Server 2016 is the minimum server operating system in all environments, many of us, simply because of how many years that's going to take, are going to be close to retirement. Think about it, okay? We're certainly going to be somewhere on average between 55 to 60 years old, and we're hopefully not having to kick servers every day for a job, but maybe we are. You can restrict privileged accounts simply in Active Directory on the user account properties, and you can say this account can only log on to these workstations. That's a really easy way to stop someone using a domain admin account on their local workstation, is to have a list of servers where that account's allowed to log on and only allow that account to log on to those servers. You can also restrict when a privileged account can be used. You can say only use it at this particular time of day. So you can see up on the screen there, I've limited it and I've said only during office hours can this account be used. Why? Is that a good idea? Well, it's not going to save everything. Every bit of security is just tightening the knobs and making sure things are a little more secure. Nothing's going to work perfectly. But a lot of attackers try and run their attacks in the middle of the night when no one's watching. So if you've limited the use of these privileged accounts so that they can only be used during the day or at specific times, then that's going to be a lot less likely to actually work against your network. Applying all the privileges. There is a tendency to add all accounts that require privileges to the domain admins group. Who here has people on the service desk who are members of the domain admin group? Really? Some of you have become very shy. That's not very New Zealand of you, is it? There is. This happens. We've got someone on the service desk. Let's add them to domain admins. Why? Well, because delegating the permissions that they need is difficult. Let's just give them all the permissions, all the privileges. Should all the accounts in your domain admins group actually be there? When was the last time you looked at that group and really thought, how many of these accounts are necessary? Has anybody done that in the last 6 months? Wow, you're all really good. Santa's bringing you presents. Does your organisation have a solution for controlling the membership of sensitive groups? Does anybody actually have anything in place right now that does that? Okay, what are you using? Okay. So you're using just permissions on the group? Yeah. Okay. Is there anybody using a third-party solution or anything like that? Okay, so monitoring it using SCOM. So at least there's something watching that. But think of it this way, and that's the important thing. If someone was added to the domain admins group in the middle of the night, would you be notified about it? Or is it something that you'd just discover if you happen to look in that group? Who here would actually be notified if someone's added to the domain admins group? So about 10% of you. Multi-admin role account. Now, why is this a bad habit? You've got a domain admin account that also happens to be a SQL administrator account, that also happens to be the account that runs the configuration manager, that runs Exchange, that also manages the Azure tenancy. Who's using these super accounts that have got all the powers? Anybody? Yeah, there's a couple of you. This happens, is that literally it's like, okay, we've got Frank's admin account. So rather than give Frank a different admin account for all of these different services, what we're just going to do is we're going to take Frank's one account and we're just going to keep bolting on privileges to it so that when Frank needs to use a privileged account, he only needs to use the one thing. He's got a green lantern ring and that does everything. The better way of doing this is to have a separate account for each different thing that needs to be done. Again, it's a lot more work. But the reason is that if Frank's account gets compromised, all of those other roles are compromised. And you don't want to have Frank's account get compromised and think, oh gosh, Exchange is vulnerable. This is vulnerable. That's vulnerable. That's vulnerable. That's vulnerable. Yes, it's possible that if, for example, a domain admin account is compromised, that some of these things can actually be, you know, eventually compromised, but you don't sort of want it to be get one account and I've got the keys to the kingdom entirely. At least make your attackers work for the keys to the kingdom. Who here has an account lockout policy for administrators? Okay, about 15-20% of you. If an admin account incorrectly authenticates three times, it's probably actually a really good idea to simply lock the account and then have someone have to come and unlock it. Because that means either your administrator has had a very long night and perhaps might have lubricated themselves with some alcoholic... Or they just might be having a bad day and they're typing badly. Or it could be that someone's trying to, you know, brute force the administrator account. There's no reason not to do this. And that's the other thing. There's a lot of, well, this is inconvenient for me. Yes, security is inconvenient. But it will make your network a lot more secure. Weak administrator password policy. Who here has exempted? I mean, certainly if you've got password never expires, you've already exempted yourself from the password policy. But what you need to do is you may need to make sure administrators' passwords need to be complex, and they probably should be longer than just the normal 8 characters, because these are the most sensitive accounts in your organisation, and people go, well, we'll give them the same security as the person who's on reception has for their logon account. And you can see when you think about it that way, that doesn't really make sense. Now, I want to talk about a new technology that's going to be available in Server 2016, and this is called a just-in-timed privileged access management. They haven't settled on the name entirely. The way it works is it requires Microsoft Identity Manager, it requires Server 2016, and it requires what's called a privileged account forest. Now, when you have this in place, what happens is that rather than there being a privileged account that's always a privileged account, you create temporary privileged accounts so that an account has temporarily elevated privileges to perform a privilege function, and there's a whole workflow behind it. For example, if someone needs to spend the day adding user accounts to Active Directory, they go through, they fill out a docket, that's approved, and then their normal user account is suddenly added temporarily to the groups that are assigned those privileges. Now, the cool thing about the way this works is that after a certain amount of time has passed, they're automatically removed from those groups. So it's called just-in-time administration because literally you only get the permissions when you need them through an authorised process rather than having them all the time. And the reason that Microsoft made this switch is if you look at like how Eric Snowden attacked the NSA, and how a lot of these attacks occurred, it's because there's been these accounts where there has been privileges loaded on and people have gone after those accounts. Whereas if you're suddenly taking that away, that the accounts are only privileged when they need to actually perform that task, then that makes the entire environment a lot more secure. So that's something that, of course, requires a lot more work. But because we're also getting the tools to automate a lot of this and make it a lot easier, once it's set up, it actually becomes a lot more straightforward. There's another product called Enterprise Random Password Manager that does something fairly similar. It works right now with anything you've got. And what that does is with Enterprise Random Password Manager, you check out an administrator account when you need to perform a task. So if you need to perform an exchange task, you basically sign onto a web portal, you request the account, and you're either on a list of people who are automatically approved for that account, or someone has to manually approve it. Now, what happens there is, again, for a short amount of time, you have the privileges to go and perform that task. And then what happens is, after that time expires, the password's automatically rotated, so it's not something that you know. So that then the next time you do it, you have to get a new admin password for that account. And the whole point of that is, again, so that admin accounts are literally only going to work for a couple of hours as admin accounts before returning to be non-privileged accounts or being locked away so that you have to go and request the account again. So these are two different approaches. This is a third-party solution. The Microsoft one is obviously going to be a Microsoft solution. But the requirements of the Microsoft solution are basically going to be you need all of this new infrastructure. If you want to do it with your existing infrastructure, look at something like Enterprise Random Password Manager. There are also other solutions that do the same thing. The future is also a thing called Just Enough Administration. Just Enough Administration is something that Jeffrey Snover has been talking about. And what Just Enough Administration is, if you've ever heard of PowerShell sessions, session restrictions. What you can do in PowerShell is you can set it up so that people only connect to a specific endpoint. And that endpoint has a limited set of commands and a limited set of commands that the thing can be run against. So again, if someone needs to go and perform a task on the Exchange server, they connect to the Exchange server and they can only use a very small number of commands. Or they connect to a Windows server and they can only do things with a DHCP server. The idea is to take what we've done in the past, which is we've given people the Green Lantern ring and we've given them the ability to do everything, and we instead say no. And there'll be a whole lot of templates that you'll be able to apply and download from Microsoft, which is basically, okay, you have DHCP scope admin rights. and then you make that connection to the DHCP server, and all you can do is muck around with that DHCP scope. It means that these attacks like the pass the hash attack, should someone even get your credentials, they're really constricted by what they can do with it, and that's another way that security works. Okay, who here, let's get back to really silly stuff, who here's ever disabled Windows Firewall just to get something to work? It's easier to turn it off than it is to figure out how to create the right rules. And sometimes, again, we get vendor documentation that says, go and create this rule. And we create the rule and it doesn't work. And then we just go, turn it off. GUIs on servers that don't need GUIs. Now, this one is, if you think about it, most servers in your organization are doing things like being domain controllers, DNS servers, DHCP servers, and file servers. And while these are important roles, they're also roles that don't require a GUI. You can do this very effectively with server core. And the reason that you don't do it with GUIs is that GUIs increase the attack surface. The attack surface is merely, if you've got more and more components installed on the machine, then there's more and more ways that that machine can be exploited. If you reduce the number of components that are installed on the machine is less likely to be exploited. Now, a lot of you will have looked at server core and gone, wow, this is difficult to administrate, I'm going to use a GUI. At some point, you need to get to the point where you are quite happy not doing things with a GUI. And the thing with server core, at least with 2012 and 2012 R2, is you can put the GUI on and then you can take it off, because eventually you get to the point where you're remotely administering these servers anyway, and you don't need to remotely administer a server using remote desktop. You can use a management console to make a remote connection, or you can do it with PowerShell. There's also NanoServer, which is coming in Server 2016. NanoServer is the minimum footprint version of server. It makes server core look like it's bloated. NanoServer runs with about 450 meg of RAM and about half a gig of disk space. So you can have a domain controller or a DNS server, DNS server is probably more appropriate, that's running as a very small form factor server. So one, it's taking no resources, but the other advantage is it's absolutely minimum attack surface and you almost never need to reboot it to apply software updates, because when you're looking at that level of Windows Server, there's far fewer software updates that need to be applied. Who here has ever surfed the web on a server? This is a really not good thing to do. It's something Frank does. Now, often we do this because we need software off the internet to install whatever application we're working on. So we fire up Internet Explorer because it's quicker, because we've remote desktoped across, and we need to download it. Of course, that is the vector for the majority of infections these days, is that people navigate to websites and then something gets injected onto their server that they don't know about, and then the server becomes compromised, or the workstation becomes compromised. It's simply that's the other reason why you don't browse the web, or you shouldn't browse the web on your work computer using an account that has local administrator privileges. That's the whole reason that user account control is in there. It's so that if something wants to try and elevate, you'll get kind of prompted for it. But a lot of malware is even smarter than that, bless you, in that if you're just with a normal user account when you're doing anything on your computer, there's a lot less chance that anything that is attacking you is actually going to be effective at doing so. So if you do need to get software off the internet, go and use your own workstation and then transfer it to the server using another method. Don't open a browser on the server and then start to use that to go and, you know, log into these sites. Because the first thing you do, of course, is you open the browser and it says Internet Explorer enhanced security configuration is enabled. And you're like, oh, bugger. And you close that and then you turn off Internet Explorer enhanced security configuration. Then you come back and then you're suddenly going through the whole process. Do you trust this site? Yes, just trust all of them. I just want this. And then suddenly you've really, you know, got to the point where you've really pulled down the configuration of the server. There's an attitude within Microsoft now, bless you, that servers should not have GUIs. Now, they're still going to ship them, but their best practice advice is going to be, where possible, don't deploy a server with a GUI. And there's a lot more applications now that will install with a no GUI option. You can certainly run SQL Server without a GUI, and there's going to be more and more servers that do that. To get software in the future, you're also going to use OneGet or Choclity a lot more. Who's heard of these? Okay, for those of you that don't know, it's basically apt-get, which you use on Linux, for Windows. So there's a whole lot of repositories that have got software on it. So if you want to go and get software, you just open a command prompt, you use OneGet or you use Choclity, and then you retrieve the software and install it using the console rather than doing it using the browser. Ben Armstrong's doing a demonstration later today with containers, where he's going to show how you can use containers to deploy Minecraft. And all of that is done by, the first thing it does is it goes and pulls the Java package across, and then it goes and pulls the Minecraft package across. And containers don't use a GUI at all. It's all done by the command line. Comatose physical servers. This one surprised me. It turns out that a survey was done of data centers, and they found that 30% on average of servers in data centers had no activity. So what was going on was that people were deploying servers for a particular project, and this applies also to virtual machines as well, so it's not just physical servers. And then the project would finish and they'd stop using the server, but the server would stay there in the data center, or the VM would still stay there. Who here actually has a process for detecting whether or not a server that's in deployment is still being used? Okay, one of you. What is likely to happen in many organisations is that now that we've made it so easy for people to spin up virtual machines, people do spin up virtual machines and leave them there. And they don't tell anybody when they've stopped using them. So suddenly there's the VMs that are consuming resources and disk space, or servers that are consuming space in the data centre that actually aren't being used by anybody. I had that experience, you know, 15 years ago, where I found a box sitting in our server room and I said, whose is this? And I searched for who owned the workload. No one could tell me whose it was, why it was there, what it was doing. And no one had logged onto it except for me. So eventually I took the, I'll shut it down and I'll see who screams thing. I shut it down, no one ever complained. So I had no idea who that workload had belonged to. And you might be surprised to find that there's workloads in your own environment which you have no idea who owns them. Or you might know who owns them and they might have left and they're not doing anything. So it's certainly worth checking out, because if you're going to attack a network, that's a great thing to go and find, is to go and find the server that no one's using and then just to hide on that for a while. Derelict computer accounts. Derelict computer accounts sit within Active Directory. They look legitimate, but they're for machines that have long since been retired. It's worth going and getting rid of them. Orphan GPOs, there's group policy objects that people have put into Active Directory to do a task. They're no longer linked to anything, or they're linked to things, but no one's really sure why the GPO is there. Again, this is not a problem if you've got documentation, and I know documentation is a swear word for many of you, and many of you would rather visit the dentist than do documentation. But documentation's important, because you need to know, why is this thing still here? Another problem that we're getting is that many organisations still have... Who still here has functionally an Active Directory that was put in for Windows 2000 and is still being used now? Okay, so about 10% of the audience. That means that 15 years of cruft might be sitting in Active Directory. It's worth clearing it out. That's where you get an ad hoc OU structure. An OU structure is put in place that made sense 15 years ago or 10 years ago, and you're still stuck with it now. Always be willing to revise your structures, because departments get merged. Organisations restructure themselves, and sometimes Active Directory doesn't actually follow what happens. So it was set up to represent the organisation, but it doesn't change with the organisation. Derelict security groups. Security groups that are created for a particular reason and then left. And no one knows who's meant to be in those security groups, and no one remembers what those security groups get access to. One of the things I didn't put in here is file server permissions. Who here is absolutely sure that their file server and NTFS permissions lock everybody out of the files that they're not meant to have access to? You've got three people who are sure that they work. Wow. Because most people kind of look at them and go, I know that this is screwy, but I do not have the time to get file server permissions right. And that's how you get people like Eric Snowden getting access to a whole lot of, or Chelsea Manning getting access to a whole lot of secure material, simply because permissions at the State Department or at the NSA weren't properly configured. And he was able to just go and pull all of that information because someone hadn't done the permissions correctly in both cases. So all of those State Department secrets that were leaked to Edward Snowden, not Edward Snowden, to Julian Assange, were got by someone who was a low-level help desk employee who was just surfing the network looking for what he could get access to, and then copying it to a CD-ROM, burning it, and then walking out of the building. So derelict files. Who here has a process for determining whether or not files on a file share have been accessed within the last year and a half? One person, right? This is built into Windows Server 2003 and later. You can run reports using a thing called File Server Resource Manager that will tell you whether or not a file's been accessed within a specific date range. If you want to free up disk space, this is a really good way of doing it, because the reality is with files, people create a file, they'll access it for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, and then they'll never touch it again. And then it's sitting there on your server until someone decides to clean it off. If you've got a process for getting rid of those derelict files, that's a good thing, because again, you don't know what's sitting in those files. We were talking before about people leaving administrator credentials in files in places. You would be amazed what people will leave in their files. Who here has done a recovery drill in the last 12 months? Right, that's not good. You don't know that your data is protected until you actually verify that you can recover it. Microsoft found when they were doing their own recovery drills that data that they felt they thought was backed up 15% of the time couldn't still be recovered. That is that something had gone wrong in the backup process, and even though the backup process said, yeah, we're good, when they went to recover the data, they couldn't recover it because there were errors on the tape, or there'd been errors in when the data had been copied, or there were bit rot's just the process of storing something for a long time on disks means that eventually errors creep in. So if you're not performing recovery drills, you can't be certain that your data is recoverable. And it's a very bad habit that server admins have where they say, oh, look, I'm absolutely sure that we've backed up that data. And then they come to recover it and then they find, oh, actually, there's something wrong. So do recovery drills at least on a regular basis where you're checking, does the system that we've put in place actually work? Because it's great to have it work in theory, in reality is another matter. An unwillingness to document, I've talked about. Lack of configuration documentation, where if you got hit by a bus, or if you won the lottery tomorrow and then escaped to Tahiti, would someone who came in to replace you actually be able to do anything with your system, or would they go, wow, what a frank? Lack of change documentation. When someone makes a modification to a server in your organisation, do they document it? Who here has documented a change in the last week? Who here may have not been entirely accurate with the details of their documentation? Yeah, there's a few of you sitting there going, change to the server, tick, sign. No one's going to read this. Another one, treating the new OS like the old OS. This is very much a habit that we get into, especially as we're getting older. We go and adopt a new version of Windows Server, and we still treat it like the last version of Windows Server. We don't realise that there has been changes in the way that you do things, or that the old ways work, why learn the new ways? It's always worth, when you pick up a new server operating system, the first mistake you can make about it is, hey, this looks exactly like the old one, and then you keep managing it like you do the old one. Microsoft was really surprised at the blowback, to say the least, blowback against Windows 8, because they had all of this telemetry that said that people did things a certain way in Windows 7, that they launched programs in a certain way in Windows 7, that 80% of programs were launched from the taskbar, that very few people were actually using the start menu. That's why they kind of thought, hey, we can get rid of the start menu and no one's going to be upset about it. And then we get Windows 10 that shows, oh, okay, yeah, now we understand. Who here goes into the event logs and looks and goes, wow, there's only a couple of red ones and there's only a couple of yellow ones. I think we're pretty good. Most breaches have involved, on average, 3 months of network reconnaissance. Hostile activity, so some of you might have heard about the Target breach last year, where something like 31 million credit cards were stolen. And this was an awesome breach. It's certainly worth reading up on. But there was hostile activity in their event logs for 3 months prior to this attack. And what the attackers did is they managed to get in through an air conditioning vendor's credentials, and they managed to attack their configuration, their operating system deployment configuration. Because what Target did is that they completely dropped a new image every day onto their cash registers. So what the attackers did is that they infected this image with malware that would automatically intercept all credit card transactions that pass through the register. And what they did is they named the malware after a Dell management utility, so that every time this thing was flagged in an event log, the administrators at Target went, it looks like the Dell management utility's got an issue. So they left it on. When they went back through, it was really obvious what was going on. But because people looked at it and they just went, well, that kind of looks okay. I'm fine with it. I'll ignore it. When the malware spun itself up and started to be active, which happened just before Thanksgiving, which they call Black Friday in the US, or just around Thanksgiving, when they do the majority of their credit card transactions, the malware, they had 6 weeks of collecting credit card data, and it was because the Secret Service went, you know what we figured out? We found all of these fraudulent credit cards on Russian and Ukrainian websites, and we've figured out that everyone was used at a Target. And we know that you must have some sort of thing where this is going on. And then they found that there was an FTP server sitting in Target's data center that someone had spun up, and every day all of the credit card numbers would come in from the points of sale to the FTP server, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, the FTP server would open a connection to a server in Kiev and just upload everybody's credit card details. And this went on for 6 weeks. Administrators in that case ignored the breach as simply false positives. Another one is using the same password for work and private accounts. So you've got your standard account, and then you've got your administrator account, and you've got your Hotmail account. And people are using their Hotmail account password as their domain administrator password. Now, work email, and you will increasingly see as we move to things like Office 365 and Azure Active Directory, is the same as your logon. And passwords have been exposed in breaches. We all heard about the Ashley Madison breach. We all saw the vast number of people in organisations that had actually signed up for Ashley Madison using their work credentials. So think about this. You're signing up to these websites, or people in your organisation will sign up to these websites using their credentials, which increasingly their email address, their work email address, is their logon credential. They're probably using the same password. The only way to fix that is to enforce a rigorous password policy where everybody's got to change their password. Because Ashley Madison might not get you to change your password every 30 days, but you can make damn sure that everybody in your organisation does change their password every 30 days. Hard-coded IP addresses in applications and settings. This is a big killer in things like SQL Server connection strings. Use DNS names. As I was saying yesterday, when upgrading, one of the biggest problems people have when upgrading is that simply there's hard-coded IP addresses. So they upgrade a server, it gets a new IP address, and then suddenly something breaks. Try to avoid this. There's a reason that we use DNS, and this is one of them. And make sure then you don't have your host's file hard-coding them either. Now, the final one is lack of administrator auditing. And I'm using a bit of Latin here. Who knows what the Latin on the screen means? Anybody? Who guards the guards? Who watches the watchmen? Okay. Administrator accounts are the most powerful accounts in the organisation. They are the ones that any attacker or someone attacking your organisation is going to go for. Your account could be compromised and you might not know about it. This is why you have to have administrator event logging. You must log what administrator accounts are doing so that you can make sanity checks to see if what is being done is what is meant to be done. If you're not making a record of what's going on, it becomes increasingly hard when something does go wrong to actually figure out what the problem has been and what was actually done. Okay, now, does anybody want to suggest their own bad habits? No one. Oh, you all must be wonderfully perfect and you can't think of anything. Okay, so in this session, I went through a more than 30 different bad administrator habits. There's a list there. All of these slides are available on the website. There will also be a recording of this session that is available for you to download, probably in a day or so. Thank you very much for your attention. If you've got questions, please come up after the session. Thank you.